From CAFE, this is United Security. I'm Lisa Monaco.
And I'm Ken Weinstein.
Hey, good morning, Ken Weinstein.
Good morning. Good to see you.
How you doing? Well, good to see you via Zoom.
It's all going well.
Yeah?
Enjoying keeping an eye on what's going on. Watching the Democratic Convention.
So have you been? Have you been tuned in?
I have been. Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's must-see TV, right?
It really is. You know, and I actually didn't expect much. And this applies to both conventions because of the virtual context. I was worried that it would be flat.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have the sort of the grandeur of the big conventions. And look, that is the case. But I actually think it's, you know, especially because of the VP announcement, you know, that had some suspense. And then so there's some excitement around that. But also, I just think it's actually gone fairly well. And we've actually had some substantive statements by people that have been important. And the best thing is the montage musical of The Rising.
Totally.
With Bruce Springsteen, which, of course, just makes me happy just thinking about it.
Talk about the most kind of predictable from you and me commentary and the most uncontroversial, which is huge kudos for the organizers getting that Rising montage and that video that opened it. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, and not to talk bad about our organizers, but I do recall that you and I had one particular request when they asked us to do this podcast. We said we'd do it if they could arrange with Bruce Springsteen that we could use The Rising as our music theme, and they completely failed. We just asked them to make one phone call to Bruce. That's all we asked.
Exactly. Huge whiff on that request.
I'm not sure why Joe Biden was able to do it.
But I do love our music, and the composer did a great job on that.
Yeah, we have great music.
My only other comment on the convention organizing, I mean, I know nothing about organizing a convention and even less about doing one virtually, but it's made for some really interesting watching, although some of the kind of video montages of people clapping from their couch is a little ox, a little awkward.
Well, you got to make do, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it's been good. So that's what I've been doing. Besides, you know, other, you know, really stimulating, exciting things like filling out timesheets for my law firm practice and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Much more exciting than the kind of things that you've been doing, I think.
Yeah.
Sort of much more mundane things like helping to select the candidate for the next vice president of the United States, little things like that.
Yeah, well, it's you're referring to what's, you know, it's been publicly announced that I was one of the people involved in and coordinating the vetting process for the vice president's selection of Senator Kamala Harris as the vice president, now official vice presidential nominee for the Democratic ticket. So, yeah, it was lots and lots of work and lots of lawyers involved, Ken. No surprise.
No surprise. It is D.C., lots of lawyers.
Yeah.
So, look, I know you can't talk about that particular process that you went through, but just maybe just for our listeners' sake, you know, just go through what is a vetting process as it relates to the vice presidential candidate.
So Ken, you're right. I can't talk about the specific process we went through or anything about that in terms of who was vetted and any of that process or who was involved. But, you know, it might be interesting for people to understand, you know, what is vetting, just taken out of the context of the vice presidential race. You know, it's a weird word, actually, when you think about it, but it really just means scrutiny and evaluating somebody for a particular job or role. So anybody who applies for a job gets some form of vetting, and I think everyone can relate to that. But, you know, the bigger the job, the more public the role, the more detailed the scrutiny. And you and I both went through vetting because we held positions of presidential appointments where we went through the Senate confirmation process. So that's a form of vetting. But, you know, I think one of the things for folks to understand is there is, and it's gotten a lot of attention in the vice presidential context, but there's a kind of a legal aspect to it and a political aspect to it. But the legal aspect is really what's considered the vetting piece, right? And that's why there's lots of lawyers involved. It's done by lawyers because it's really a detailed investigation of somebody's background, from their educational background. You know, did they in fact go to school at the places they said they went to school? Did they earn the degrees they said that they earned? You know, obviously things like criminal history, affiliations, potential kind of conflicts of interest with the role that a person might have. So you're looking for anything that's obviously disqualifying for a role. Somebody who wants to be a federal judge, probably not going to be somebody who's had a criminal conviction, right? But more broadly than that, you're also looking for issues or vulnerabilities that are going to help inform the ultimate decision maker about that job or that role in evaluating the person's kind of suitability for the role. How does their background and everything you find in the vetting process inform or reflect on that person's judgment, their decision-making, their ethics, the rigor that they would apply to whatever job they're being considered for?
You're also looking for things that might be exploited politically, right? There might be things in a person's background, and you can bet, with opposition research being what it is these days, adversaries are going to find these things and want to exploit them. So that goes to something that might not be disqualifying, but that you just want to know about in assessing whether a particular person should or shouldn't be the candidate.
Sure. Although I'd say, when you and I went through vetting, I'm sure people were looking for the same stuff on us, right?
Right? For the political positions, right.
I'm happy to vouch for the fact that you are indeed trustworthy.
Well, thanks.
Although I took no part in your vet for when you were appointed.
You're not going to take blame for that.
No, exactly.
Well, look, kudos on the process. I'm not going to comment one way or the other about the outcome of the process, but the fact that it was a completely buttoned up process, that there was no leak, that's a tough thing to do in this day and age. And kudos to you and your colleagues for doing that.
And as you can see, I'm maintaining that that streak by not giving you any information about the particular process.
I'm very frustrating.
I know.
Should have given you a few drinks before the podcast.
Yeah, it's my goal in life to frustrate you on these things, Ken.
Okay, so let's move on to the first sort of news topic of the day. So last time we talked about an announcement that had been issued not long before our last podcast by a Bill Evanina, who's the director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. And he made a fairly sparse statement about the threats that might be looming in relation to the upcoming election. And he talked about the threat of foreign interference from Iran, Russia, and China. And as we discussed, it was a very sparse report.
I'll say, Ken, you're sparse, I think, is generous. As I recall, some critics said it was so general as to be meaningless.
And it was. It was not only, sparse on specifics and details. It didn't give readers, i.e. the U.S., the American public, an understanding of what sort of the hierarchy of threat was. You had Iran, China, and Russia all sort of discussed on a par. And keeping in mind that what the purpose of that statement was, which is basically to give the American people what's called a defensive briefing. And that's a term I think we've used before, but that's when the intelligence community identifies a U.S. person who might be a target of influence efforts or intelligence efforts by a foreign government. They'll go to that person and say, hey, we want you to know somebody might be trying to compromise you. Somebody in the Russian service might be trying to get you to give secrets or what have you. That's called the defensive briefing. So the purpose of this statement was to basically give the U.S., the American public, a defensive briefing. So as we head toward the presidential elections, you should understand that these are the efforts being made by foreign adversaries to try to shape public opinion. So be vigilant to that. And to the extent that that was the purpose, I think critics said that initial statement was woefully inadequate.
So it kind of landed with a thud, right? It got a lot of criticism for not really telling anybody anything that wasn't already apparent. And as you say, for lumping Russia, China, and Iran all together. So fast forward to August 7th, which was, they must have been polishing this next statement right when you and I were doing our last podcast, because the next statement that Bill Evanina and the intelligence community issued happened on August 7th, the day after we were talking about this. And in that statement, it seemed to me, it read like trying to take another swing at the whole effort. And the next statement seemed to be responding to the criticisms that he got for not really putting much kind of meat on the bones with the first statement. And it did go a little further. It said that Russia was using measures primarily to denigrate Vice President Biden in the election. So it made a forward-leaning statement in that sense. But it also said something about China. It said that China was hoping that Trump will lose. It specifically said that China prefers that President Trump, who Beijing sees as unpredictable, according to the statement. It said that China prefers that Trump doesn't win re-election. And so I think a lot of people were kind of scratching their head on that statement to say, well, where's the beef, so to speak? Where's the backup for that statement? And it seemed pretty convenient, too, because, of course, President Trump has made a lot of statements about his view, his assertion that China prefers Vice President Biden. So this next statement, the subsequent statement, while it had more information in it, more words on the page, it, I think, met with a lot of consternation as well. But I don't know, what was your take on that second statement?
Well, look, I give him credit for providing more information. And specifically for acknowledging that the evidence or the intelligence suggests that Russia is involved in these efforts and that the efforts by Russia are designed to denigrate Vice President Biden, because obviously that's been a major issue historically as to the 2016 election, as to whether Russia was trying to denigrate Hillary Clinton and whether it favored President Trump. The problem I see with this is, once again, the purpose is to try to really notify the American people with specificity as to the threat that they're facing and the kind of influence that they might be subject to. And, you know, the reality is Russia is like major leagues in this effort, and they're the big boys, right? And we saw that in 2016. We've seen that in their efforts against a lot of the Western European countries over the last few years, against the sort of old Soviet satellite states, where they've been honing this their skills in this area. And China, you know, obviously I'm not dismissing China as a threat. And obviously, you know, as we discussed last time, China was hacking into the campaigns back in 2008, and you and I were both involved in making sure the campaigns got briefed about that threat. But that was an information gathering effort. And China has historically been more focused on stealing intellectual property. And while I'm sure they are involved in these influence efforts, I mean, the reality of the intelligence, not being inside the intelligence community, is that Russia is the big player there. And in fact, there was a recent report by a think tank, the German Marshall Fund think tank, that, you know, in terms of $300 million that have been spent by authoritarian regimes, of which both China and Russia are included, 82% of that money that was devoted to trying to inappropriately influence foreign elections was spent by Russia. So That suggests to me that, you know, a complete recitation of the facts underlying the threat would highlight Russia's designs. And also, I think there's more intelligence out there that hopefully could be sufficiently sanitized to protect sources and methods that could be laid out for American people to see how Russia is going about doing this. In this statement from Evanina, they cite a Ukrainian official who is spreading claims about corruption on the part of Joe Biden as evidence of Russia's efforts to denigrate Joe Biden. I'm quite confident there's much more direct Russian role in that effort.
Look, I think, unfortunately, we are in an era where sometimes it seems like the intelligence community is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't, right?
Absolutely.
And my first reaction when I read the second statement from Evanina and the intelligence community was, all right, this is a response to the criticism they got on the previous statement. And, you know, that's a difficult position to be in, to look like you're responding to kind of political critics. And that's never a good place. But, you know, as you scrutinize what was in the statement, as you said, it's very hard to square on the kind of record that we have to really have Russia, China, and Iran all lumped together. So you've got, on the one hand, this voluminous record of their efforts, their tactics, very specifically laid out both in the Mueller report, now in volumes by the Senate intelligence community. And then you really just have, talk about sparse, you know, no record of China's efforts in this regard. And I should say, I don't know what we don't know, right? We haven't seen that evidence or that intelligence put forward as to what China might be doing or what Iran might be doing. But in the absence of that, it makes one wonder why they're being all lumped together and not really delineated more clearly as to how we should be thinking about these.
Yeah, and you use the word voluminous, and that takes us to volume 5 of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the 2016 election and the interference thereof. that is the output of their multi-year investigation. It's 966 pages. I know, Lisa, in your spare time, you've read every one of them.
And when I'm done, it will form a great doorstop. I joke. I mean, it's actually an impressive piece of work. I mean, it's a pretty blockbuster report. Right. When you think about it, this investigation has been 3 years running. I think over 200 interviews of current and former officials, including yours truly. And we can talk about that since that's been made public in the report. The Intelligence Committee interviewed current officials like Jared Kushner, Steve Bannon, former official, Donald Trump Jr., and others. And of course, former Obama officials, as I said, including myself. Susan Rice, Dennis McDonough, Jay Johnson, John Brennan, Jim Clapper, you know, all of that has now been part of the public record.
Yeah, and they find that there's a significant effort by the Russians to try to influence our election. They found that there were contacts with the Trump campaign that raised serious counterintelligence concerns. You know, so they, on a bipartisan basis, found that this was an aggressive effort by the Russians to disrupt our election, similar to what the Mueller investigation found. And then you had separate findings by Democratic committee members and the Republican committee members as to the question of whether there was quote unquote collusion between the campaign and the Russians. And of course, that's been the major issue as to whether there was any active participation by the campaign in any way to facilitate this interference effort. Different views on that, predictably. The Republicans touted the fact that there is no evidence. They found no evidence to substantiate that. Democrats looked at the same evidence and said that they found a significant indicia of coordination between, in particular, Manafort and a colleague of his, who was he was very close to, who actually was a member of Russian intelligence, and they see that differently. But in terms of the actual report itself, a good bipartisan effort and finding about the severity of what the Russians are trying to do. And just if I could just give a shout out to the Senate Intelligence Committee. I represented, as you mentioned, John Brennan and Jim Clapper and David Cohn, who's the deputy director of the CIA, in their appearances before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And it was a joy dealing with them. It always has been.
So as somebody who was a witness, right, and on the interviewing side of both the staff and the members, I'm not sure I'd say it was a pleasure.
Pleasure, relatively speaking.
Right, exactly. I had a few takeaways from this final installment of the report. You know, there was, I think, really important conclusions and facts laid out about Paul Manafort, about WikiLeaks. And importantly, particularly because of the moment we're in now, you know, just a few months before an election and a transition, potentially a transition, right? There was some really interesting, I think, facts laid out about how the transition was handled in 2016. So maybe you take a minute just to unpack some of those takeaways. You know, I think big issue that they found was that Paul Manafort, of course, the former Trump campaign chair, who was later dismissed from that job, but remained in the Trump orbit. And he was, of course, Paul Manafort, people will recall, was convicted of bank and tax fraud. He ultimately pled guilty to conspiracy against the United States and obstruction of justice. The committee concluded that Manafort was working with a guy named Konstantin Kalimnik. Now, this is a guy who the committee identified as a Russian intelligence officer. And that's a difference from the Mueller report. The Mueller report did not ultimately state that as plainly. The committee said Kalimnik was a Russian intelligence officer. He was working with Manafort. Manafort sought to share campaign information, including sensitive polling data, with Kalimnik. And so that was a big conclusion and set of facts laid out by the committee in this report. The committee also said that there was some information suggesting that Kalimnik may have been connected to the Russian hack in 2016 of the Democratic National Committee. So, you know, that's a blockbuster kind of headline coming out of this committee report. The bipartisan portion of the report also said that Manafort's role on the campaign, and this is a quote which really struck me, represented a grave counterintelligence threat. I mean, that's a pretty stark statement from a bipartisan Senate committee. The second thing that really struck me about the report was that they concluded that Trump and senior campaign officials sought advanced information on the WikiLeaks dumps of emails, and that they sought that information through Roger Stone, and that Trump actually spoke to Stone about WikiLeaks, even though Trump, in his written responses to the special counsel, to Special Counsel Mueller and his team, Trump said he had no recollection of such discussions. So it was pretty clear that the committee was kind of calling BS on that, for lack of a better word. And then finally, and this I think is really important for the current moment that we're in, the committee report said that the Russians, and they said this very, very plainly, the Russians took advantage of the Trump transition team. Again, this is in 2016, and their relative inexperience and opposition to Obama policies in order to, quote, pursue unofficial channels, right? This is Russia trying to exploit the Trump transition team to their own advantage. And the report specifically calls out the need for, in the future, to be more diligent about guarding against Russian interference during a transition period. So again, as we're 75 days out from a presidential election, I think that's a really, really instructive thing. You know, the bottom line, I think, from my perspective, is this was a bipartisan report in the main. We should mention that there were two appendices, one for separate Republican views and separate Democratic views. But the ultimate findings from this volume of the Senate Intelligence Report and the Mueller report are strikingly similar, right? The Senate Intel Report, this fifth volume, says the Russian government engaged in aggressive, multifaceted effort to influence or attempt to influence the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. And Mueller, of course, in this, you know, much quoted line from his report, said the Russian government interfered in the 2016 presidential election in sweeping and systematic fashion. So bottom line, you've got two of the same conclusions.
Moving on, let's look at something else that caught my attention, which is the report from last week that the Justice Department had filed charges and seized millions of dollars of cryptocurrency that was being used to fund terrorist groups, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS to the military arm of Hamas. Caught my eye because, you know, this is traditional terrorist financing, which is the kind of thing that kind of investigation and prosecution that we did extensively after 9/11, and is a major way of trying to disrupt and dismantle terrorist groups. But it's a terrorist financing case with the new twist, the new modern twist of cryptocurrency. Interesting case.
Yeah, so it caught my eye because it was announced by our former division, the National Security Division, the division of the Justice Department that you and I both led at different times. And it was touted as this unprecedented crackdown on terrorist fundraising on social media. And, you know, this is a new twist on a tried and true method of using the banking system and the illicit movement of funds to fund terrorist activity.
In this case, they're using cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. And I'm not even going to pretend to be an expert in blockchain technology. And if I wanted to give a real good explanation of it, I'd probably get my 11-year-old to do it, since she's much more techno expertise than I am. But the whole idea of the blockchain is, and it's literally just it's a creation of the last 11 or 12 years, is that there's this digital ledger. Cryptocurrency can travel over a distributed network, where, you know, it's not like one place where all the money is kept. It's transferred among people. And there's a notion out there that it can be done anonymously, or at least with more privacy. Though, in fact, and I think this case kind of highlights this fact, the anonymity is easily pierced. And here we had these terrorist organizations using social media to openly solicit contributions of cryptocurrency, specifically for terrorist violent activities. People did it. They provided the cryptocurrency. And the Justice Department and fellow intelligence and law enforcement agencies were able to identify those transfers, seize them. And actually, in one case, they actually operated the system that actually received those contributions, and so pretended to be the recipient, and received the contributions, and B, received the information about the people who were sending those contributions in specifically for terrorist activities. So really a masterful piece of investigation and prosecution.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and it's interesting, this whole notion of the use of cryptocurrency, you know, it's got supporters and detractors, unsurprisingly, right? The supporters of this new technology and this kind of peer-to-peer way of exchanging funds say, you know, look, this is great. It's a virtual currency. It allows you to exchange money with people who might not have access to the traditional banking system, right? The problem of the unbanked, right, is a significant issue. And it might allow for money flows into people who don't have necessarily access or ready access to those systems. There's also an argument that it is more secure. It allows for secure transactions. It can allow for more privacy and security in those transactions, precisely because, as you said, of the distributed nature of the blockchain technology that underpins the actual cryptocurrency of things like Bitcoin. You know, there's also an argument that it can help law enforcement in the sense that the blockchain ledger can be kind of a permanent artifact, if you will, and the information is global, right? And so in some sense, it might be more accessible. That is an argument that people have made. But on the other hand, you know, critics have argued that cryptocurrency, as has been pretty effectively exposed in this case that we're talking about, is a new weapon, right, for terrorists and other bad actors, a way to fund their activities surreptitiously. Right. But as you said, we should be clear, terror finance is nothing new. Right. The use of illicit money flows to fund terrorism is pretty old, relatively speaking. But this is a new kind of vector now that bad actors are trying to exploit.
Yeah. Look, they're both law enforcement and national security concerns with any new technology that has its dark sides and positive sides. Though, you know, I saw one report recently that less than 1% of the transactions with cryptocurrency, or maybe it was Bitcoin specifically, were related to illegal activity. So the vast majority is legal activity. And providing the services to the unbanked around the world, which is, you know, terribly important. And, you know, part of the rarity, I guess, of the illegality is because there actually is a way for law enforcement to identify bad actors who are using cryptocurrency technology to fund wrongdoing. But then, you know, look, as with any new technology, the regulatory schemes are immature and are developing. And I'm sure wrongdoers, both nation states and criminal types, are trying to take advantage of that for money laundering and other purposes. I read an article about how the Seychelles Islands, you know, we're onboarding clients without, you know, any identifying information, which, of course, you know, makes it hard to try to identify money laundering and that kind of thing. So, you know, it'll probably take time for the regulatory regime around the world to catch up with this technology. And in the meantime, people will try to take advantage of it. And we've seen that. So, for example, I think in the Mueller report, they talked about how some of the Russian operatives who are conducting their information warfare and their cyber attacks against the 2016 election laundered $90,000 worth of cryptocurrency in order to fund those operations. So pretty good example of a nation state engaged in malign activities using the cryptocurrency network to fund those activities.
So I see it used in cybersecurity cases, right? In work that I'm doing with companies, you know, that Bitcoin is what's demanded from bad actors who are conducting ransomware attacks. So it's becoming something that is being used more and more in some of these schemes. So I don't know, for me, Ken, the bottom line is it is certainly a brave new world, right? We've now got terror groups and other bad actors, as we've described, using these new means and adapting their terror finance activities for the digital age. And there's going to be a lot more to see in this space. So we've just been talking about the double-edged sword of the technology of blockchain and the cryptocurrency that it enables. There's a lot going on in the technology space and national security space over the last week or so. We've got new executive orders that the Trump administration has issued, specifically going after TikTok and WeChat. Now, you may need to get your 11-year-old again, Ken, to explain to you what TikTok is.
Are you kidding? She spends 23 of 24 hours a day on TikTok.
I haven't seen any of your TikTok. I shudder to think what a 15-second TikTok dance video from Ken Weinstein would look like.
Oh, it's hot. It's hot. Yeah.
Thanks for that visual. So, you know, this caught a lot of headlines. One, because it involves TikTok and, you know, everybody, most people know what that is, or they've got kids who, you know, are constantly on it. But it is, these are pretty important moves when you think about both the intersection of technology and the data issues around privacy and national security that people are focused on, and what it says about the ratcheting tensions with China. So let's kind of unpack what these executive orders were.
Yeah, so President issued executive orders as to both TikTok and WeChat. TikTok is that, what we all know, is that service that allows short videos to be disseminated. And then WeChat is a chat service.
And a payment platform. It's, you know, what everybody in China uses.
Starting with the TikTok order, the president declared, and this is, you know, pursuant to his authority, he declared that there, you know, is a national emergency that he'd announced in a previous executive order back in 2019 about the need to secure our country's information and communications technology and supply chain against foreign interference. That's the emergency that he had already announced. And based on that emergency, in this new executive order, he said that they needed to take action against TikTok, because TikTok and its use was seen as a threat to that emergency, that it might add to that emergency. And specifically, that the executive order said that within 45 days, the Secretary of Commerce would determine which transactions would be banned with the company that owns TikTok, which is called ByteDance, a Chinese company. And so the import of this is to ban transactions with ByteDance and TikTok, which is pretty striking, because TikTok is used, as you said, by every kid in this country. It has a significant presence, offices and the like, here in the United States. It has investments in the United States. It has, terms of service with all the people who use it. And so, taken to its fullest extent, this could ban any interaction and subject somebody to punishment for any interaction, business interaction with TikTok. Similar executive order, basically the identical executive order as it relates to WeChat. And these were put in place without a lot of explanation, other than sort of a general reference to the threats that they were concerned about. And that specifically they were, you know, that the reason for this was, as I said, to try to protect the American telecommunications and internet, and to prevent these systems from being used to collect information about U.S. persons that maybe the Chinese could take advantage of.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, let's kind of go at here what the concerns might be, right, that motivated some of this. On the one hand, you've got massive amounts of data collection going on in something like TikTok and WeChat, right? Collecting data. I mean, they're not alone in this, quite obviously, but collecting data on U.S. users that could be used by the Chinese government for intelligence purposes and other reasons. So, you know, that is one set of concerns animating, I think, potentially these actions. And then you've got the broader concerns that China is going to use the data that it collects through these services and others, coupled with its, you know, significant control that it exerts over Chinese companies. It could use this data to inform and accelerate its own technology development efforts and kind of win this or advance in the kind of innovation race that China and the U.S. Have really been dueling in for the last couple of years, right? And this is of a piece, I think, with the Trump administration's effort to move in a more, to try and isolate more China and the purchase of Chinese technology. We see this in the efforts to get our allies not to purchase from Huawei, et cetera, and to use Huawei to build their 5G grids, et cetera. So this is all of a piece with the strategy to isolate China, to keep them from advancing in this innovation race.
Yeah, so in terms of the rationale, the rationales that have been floated are the ones that you know, in terms of the specific threat that relate to the national emergency that the president announced in the previous executive order. It's the fact that these companies might use the information. Obviously, they collect a lot of information about the users, both WeChat users and TikTok users. It's secondly that TikTok in particular might be censoring content that the Chinese government doesn't approve of. And there are concerns that they're censoring content about the Hong Kong protests and about how China treats Muslim minorities and that kind of thing. So that's obviously a concern. And then also that these platforms can be used to spread disinformation, sort of back to what we talked about in relation to the elections. But generally, there have been allegations that the Chinese government, you know, had TikTok disseminate videos that addressed conspiracy theories about how the coronavirus was spread. And so they have sort of this nest of concerns that are legitimate national security counterintelligence concerns.
We should point out the Senate voted recently to prohibit federal employees from using TikTok on their government phones, right? The Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Defense has all said, tells its employees not to use TikTok. I think the government of India banned the use of TikTok and other Chinese mobile applications. So, you know, these are not, you know, far-fetched concerns.
Not at all. And look, the broader concern that you said is that these are Chinese companies, and under Chinese law, the Chinese government can prevail upon them to do things for the Chinese government's interests. And look, you know, TikTok says they respond to these allegations. They deny that these are real concerns. They talk about how TikTok information about U.S. users is stored in the U.S. I think there's a backup in Singapore, but not in China. But it's still a very real concern that the Chinese government could lean on Chinese private companies to do their bidding. And look, you know, we've seen that over and over. You talk to U.S. Secret Service officers, and I just remember, you know, the stories are endless stories about going into hotels in China and, you know, private company hotels and pulling listening devices out of the wall when I was there for the government. And so, you know, that's an example of a private company where it's being used, you know, one way or another for the Chinese government's intelligence purposes. So it's a very real concern. So I don't want to dismiss it. The question, though, is does the president have that authority? And I'm sure this will probably be subject to a challenge both on First Amendment grounds, because this is expressive activity, also on constitutional grounds, because, you know, look, TikTok is not like one of these Hong Kong officials who's been designated in response to the new national security law over in Hong Kong. This is, you know, a company that's enmeshed in America, in our economy. It has all the constitutional protections of any other company here in the United States. So, you know, there are going to be significant legal challenges against it. But as you pointed out, the president under IEPA has that authority.
IEPA, it sounds like you just had a... Yeah, hiccup, exactly. You're referring, of course, to the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, right?
No, I'm referring to IEPA.
Yeah, right, exactly. Look, I think things that are interesting about this to me is this is a expansive use of an expansive power, right? In this ability to sanction or restrict investment in the United States, to restrict transactions with these companies. And it is another sign in this, you know, what people have described as a new Cold War between China and the United States. But let's talk about the authorities here for a second. I mean, IEPA, what you just referenced in your hiccup that you just had, is one of these very significant authorities. It's one of a group of authorities that the president has, the executive branch has, to restrict foreign investment or other interactions with companies, and under other authorities to review transactions and potentially to block them or impose conditions on them. So, you know, there's kind of a basket of these authorities. This IEPA authority is one of the most significant. And it's interesting, this authority, the one we've been talking about, IEPA, grew out of the Church Committee hearings and the reviews that were done in the 70s of a very expansive executive power, whether it was in the form of overstepping by the CIA, the FBI, and ultimately, of course, Watergate. And at the time, it's interesting, they were focused, the Church Committee, that is, was focused on this very Orwellian sounding law called the Trading with the Enemy Act. And that was used to prosecute Americans who did business with Germany in the World War I era. And I guess the view of the Church Committee at the time was that was a very expansive statute, and they were looking for something consistent with their mandate to review expansive executive power. They wanted to have Congress have some more of a role in reviewing the use of such powers. And, you know, and so this IEPA statute has some ability for Congress to review this declaration of a national emergency at regular intervals, that is, and kind of recertification processes. And I remember when I served as Homeland Security Advisor, as I'm sure you had this role too, Ken, there would regularly have to be a recertification of certain national emergencies that the president had declared, right? And you have to report that to Congress. So it is interesting that this very broad power has these roots in, you know, kind of a century ago, this original use to constrain trading with the enemy, as it were.
Yeah, it's actually just interesting to go back and look at the first use of that statute right after it was passed. You're too young to remember this, but I, of course, am not, which is the Iran hostage crisis, when the Iranians rose up and took over our embassy and held whatever several dozen Americans hostage for 400 and some days. And President Carter was in office, and this statute was new in the books. And soon after the Iranians took over the embassy, they tried to pull out $6 billion of assets that were here in the United States, obviously realizing that they were on a different footing vis-a-vis the United States now. And so they wanted to get their assets out. And the president really agonized about whether to use this authority, because he was worried about the message it would send to the world that we would be stepping in, our government would be stepping into the financial arena and seizing people's assets. But he did, which was the right call ultimately. And I think that was a sort of important test run.
Today, Iran made the first move. Within hours, the United States responded. And now the 11-day-old crisis between the two countries has moved into a new phase. This was the sequence. Iran declares its intention to withdraw all its assets from the United States. They claim $12 billion worth. The United States says no more than $6 billion. President Carter then formally declares a national emergency and blocks or freezes all property and funds of the Iranian government in this country, meaning they can't withdraw anything. And in still another counter move, the Secretary of State rushes to New York to try to block Iran's demand for a meeting of the UN Security Council, an action virtually unprecedented for this country to take. But then, it is also unprecedented for diplomats and embassy employees to be held hostage in and by the country that is supposed to be their host.
Obviously, it's hard to think of more compelling facts for using this kind of authority to intrude on the economy and financial transactions than trying to keep the Iranians who were holding our people hostage from getting their funds out. And so that was sort of the first of the most high-profile uses of this. And now we see that it's used much more regularly. And in situations like this, where maybe the threat is not so immediately connected to, you know, blatantly criminal and egregious activity, but is yet an insidious national security threat, as people allege regarding TikTok and WeChat.
But, you know, there was one other aspect to this whole TikTok story that I found kind of fascinating over the last couple of weeks. And that is this whole controversy and discussion about whether or not TikTok could be purchased and kind of spun out to a U.S. company and what that transaction would entail. And President Trump weighed in a really kind of unconventional, shall we say, way, when he talked about if such a transaction were to occur, it could only occur, in his view, if basically the U.S. government got a cut, right? Got a cut of that transaction.
But if somebody, and whether it's Microsoft or somebody else, buys it, that'll be interesting. I did say that if you buy it, whatever the price is, that goes to whoever owns it, because I guess it's China, essentially, but more than anything else. I said a very substantial portion of that price is going to have to come into the Treasury of the United States, because we're making it possible for this deal to happen. Right now, they don't have any rights unless we give it to them. So if we're going to give them the rights, then it has to come into this country. It's a little bit like the landlord-tenant without a lease. The tenant has nothing.
What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, that's a first. You know, like a referral fee for the U.S. government allowing a transaction.
Referral fee, protection money, extortion.
That's a novel one. So not really sure what to make of that. And it'll be interesting to see whether such a quote unquote cut gets paid. I'm not sure there's any legal prohibition of that, but I tell you, that's a first for me. I've never heard of anything like that.
Well, I don't think there's any legal authority for it, right?
Yeah, there's that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see though. That might be key.
Yeah. People have likened it to protection money, right? All kidding aside, there's real concerns that one could use that type of mechanism, right? To say, oh, the U.S. government's going to get a cut, and to have the president say that, you could see it being used to be kind of punitive against some companies and not against others to influence transactions. I mean, in effect, you'd have the president of the U.S. government acting as kind of an investment banker. It's a strange concept.
Right. And it is troubling. And my sense is it's probably going to sort of kind of come out in the wash. And maybe it was not a well-formed concept.
Well, the other thing we should say about this, and again, going back to our Justice Department experience, this it does kind of smack of kind of a pay-to-play, right, scheme, which is exactly what our own law prohibits our own companies from doing in other countries. So, for instance, if you're a company seeking to have a contract in some foreign country, there's laws on the books, quite obviously, to prohibit the U.S. company from paying bribes to that foreign government to get those contracts, right? And for obviously good reason, we want to discourage corruption both in the U.S. company and, frankly, we want to discourage corruption in those governments abroad. So there's a real principle at play here.
Right. And look, and if there's a challenge as to the legality of any action taken against WeChat or TikTok, the bases for that action and have to be laid out. And so, you know, they'll be tested in the courts ultimately, probably. I can tell you that my 11-year-old is very concerned about this. I'm sure this is probably the only part of the only podcast that she'll actually listen to of mine, because she...
The fate of TikTok?
Yeah, she lives by TikTok.
She clearly is not concerned about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, right?
No,
U.S. statute, right?
Or election interference or anything like that. This is all about TikTok. And in fact, she was particularly concerned a few weeks ago. You might remember there was talk about the possible demise of TikTok because apparently TikTok users sort of coordinated their actions before this President Trump's rally out in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They coordinated their efforts to buy up a lot of the tickets to that rally and then not show up.
Was your daughter part of that scheme?
On the advice of my counsel,
yeah, exactly.
I will not answer that question.
Right.
No, she was not. But there was talk about how that might have angered the administration and that might be the end of TikTok. So she took notice of that part of the evening news because she was very worried about the fate of TikTok. And so she will be following this story very carefully. And so, therefore, we're going to have a TikTok segment in basically every podcast from now on.
Oh, God.
So, look, one more thing I think we should raise before we call it a wrap. Another important, once again, a follow-on piece of breaking news from one of our earlier podcast discussions, and that's about Hong Kong and just and about what's happening after the passage of the new National Security Act in Hong Kong and the tightening control of the Chinese central government over Hong Kong and its economy and its to-date democratic processes. And look, this is worth us addressing on a regular basis because Hong Kong is a critically important part of the world economy. As you know, it was a British colony up until whatever, like 24 or 25 years ago. The British and the Chinese struck a deal where British control would be ceded to the Chinese, but it was a, quote, one country, two systems process where Hong Kong would be part of China, but Hong Kong would have its own system for 50 years. And this 50 years starting from 1997, which meant that there would be their democratic free systems that Hong Kong has historically enjoyed up until 2047. This new national security law was put in place at the end of June, I think the night before the 23rd anniversary of that agreement. So only 23 years into a 50-year agreement, basically reining in those democratic freedoms and putting Hong Kong under the same kind of anti-democratic constraints that the rest of China are under, and outlawing, you know, a variety of things: secession, subversion, terrorism, collusion with foreign governments, all things which maybe on their face sound like the kind of things that should appropriately be criminalized even in democratic institutions, but clearly are being interpreted much more broadly than we would, for example, just arresting people for having T-shirts that express sympathy for, you know, free Hong Kong. It's a real concern for any part of the world, but particular for Hong Kong, which is such an economic nerve center of the whole world. And just a few days ago, we had a high profile arrest that was of a pro democracy media magnate, Jimmy Lai, and he was arrested pursuant to this new authority.
Yeah, this is obviously connected to the themes we've been discussing throughout the episode here. This is the first sign that this national security law is being used in a way as people feared, right, to suppress dissent. So you mentioned the arrest of Jimmy Lai. He's this pro-democracy media tycoon in Hong Kong. He operates a newspaper called The Apple Daily in Hong Kong. And there was a very, very public arrest and raid of him and raid of the headquarters and the offices of Apple Daily. So it's interesting. This was done in a really public way. The raid was, you know, captured on video. One might, you know, conclude that that has an intimidation effect, who knows, but that could also be a real rallying point as well for the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong to see the way this is being used. Before this arrest of Jimmy Lai occurred, just a few days, I think, before, the Trump administration had imposed sanctions on Hong Kong's chief executive, right, the leader of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, and some other officials in response to the passage of this national security law. And this was done before Lai's arrest. Interestingly, I took note, Ken, and I don't know if you saw this, in response to Lai's arrest, you know, President Trump was asked about his reaction to this use of this draconian law against this pro-democracy activist. And he kind of inexplicably spoke about the economic advantage to the United States from cracking down on Hong Kong as a result of this national security law being imposed. In other words, because the U.S. is now going to kind of cut off some economic ties with Hong Kong as a result of this national security law being imposed, that would redound to the economic advantage of the United States.
I would like to ask your opinion about what recently happened in Hong Kong, recent attack on press freedom in Hong Kong, and Jimmy Lai was arrested, his newsroom was raided. How will the U.S. respond to this?
Well, I think it's a terrible thing, but one thing that we have done, you know, we gave tremendous incentives to Hong Kong because of freedom. We want freedom. And we were giving tremendous economic incentives to Hong Kong, and we have now withdrawn all of those incentives. And it will be impossible for Hong Kong to compete with the United States with respect to that. It just won't be, because we've taken all of the incentives away. If you look at China with the World Trade Organization as an example, they're getting tremendous because they're considered a developing nation, which is ridiculous. Why should they be a developing nation? But we're not. And they get tremendous incentives. We have, by the way, told them it's unacceptable, and we've been doing that for a long time. They understand exactly how we feel.
That was the response to the use of this national security law against a pro-democracy advocate.
The way they the Chinese government handled this is straight out of the like repression handbook, because, you know, they go into a media company and arrest this guy and his brothers in front of everybody. He doesn't get sent back to mainland China, thankfully. He's released on bail, I think a pretty substantial bail, but he's released on bail. And now he's sort of, you know, he returns as kind of as a hero, and he's not backing down. So it'd be interesting to see how they respond to that, and whether they double down on the repression or if they step back. But he's, you know, he's in serious jeopardy and they don't mess around. And I think you can look at, as an example, Jimmy Lai himself, just last in June, I think, in one of his tweets, invoked another journalist from Hong Kong who was, from China, who was arrested back in 2005, named Shi Tao. And he was arrested in 2005 because he had sent a memo out to a newspaper in New York City. And this is an official memo that prohibited journalists from writing about the upcoming anniversary of the Tiananmen Square protests. He sent that out, and that, of course, is contrary to the Chinese government's interests. They, as I recall, the government sought cooperation from Yahoo, that I guess had been the mechanism by which that memo had gone out, and it was quite controversial about whether Yahoo cooperated with the Chinese government, but ultimately the Chinese government got the information they needed to connect the sending of that memo to Shi Tao, and then Shi Tao was arrested, and I think he got 10 years in prison. And it was quite controversial over here because of the, you know, whether there was coordination or cooperation between Yahoo and the Chinese government. But I think it's the kind of thing that has been going on a long time in Chinese mainland, and the concern is that it's now going to start happening in Hong Kong.
I would just say that, you know, there was high-profile hearings and a very powerful statement by then-Congressman Tom Lantos, a Holocaust survivor.
So aside from the tragedy of what happened to the Chinese journalist, this was very controversial back here in the United States because Yahoo was roundly criticized for having allegedly cooperated with the Chinese government in unmasking who it is who sent that memo over to the United States and thereby leading to the arrest of Shi Tao. And that then triggered actually some hearings up on Capitol Hill in which Yahoo's role in that incident was explored. And there was some very powerful back and forth between then Congressman Tom Lantos and officials from Yahoo about the appropriateness of their interaction with the Chinese government.
Much of this testimony sort of reveals that while technologically and financially you are giants, morally you are pygmies. This testimony this whole morning has been an appallingly disappointing performance. I simply cannot begin to tell you how disappointing Mr. Yang's and your testimony was. The attempt to obfuscate, to divert, to describe this as a dialogue. This is a congressional testimony under oath, precipitated by the outrageous behavior of the company. And apparently not much has been learned in the process.
So Ken, before we wrap, I want to nominate our unsung hero or heroes for the week. What do you think?
Absolutely. Go for it.
So I'm going to nominate in honor of the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, which, of course, we acknowledge and commemorate this week. I'm going to nominate all those folks who are helping to get people registered to vote, regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, being able to exercise your right to vote, obviously one of the most precious rights that we hold. So folks who are registering people to vote, protecting the polls, protecting the election security infrastructure, which we'll have more to talk about, I'm sure, in upcoming episodes. That would be my nomination for unsung heroes for this week.
Absolutely. I completely second that. And I think it's appropriate for us to be citing those people on this being a national security broadcast. I think in the past, I've sort of taken for granted these are lovely people who are there helping their neighbors vote. But now we see that the vote, the election is a battleground. It's a national security battleground where we have adversaries trying to disrupt, you know, the most fundamental activity in American democracy. And the people who are helping to keep it all operate smoothly are all a part of resisting that effort and making sure that every vote counts and that we have the opportunity to select our leaders and dictate our future. So hats off to them, and they are our unsung heroes for this week.
So that's all the time we have for today. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
And in the meantime, send us any questions you might have at letters@cafe.com, and we'll do our best to answer those questions in our next podcast.
Till next time.
That's it for this week's episode of the United Security Podcast. Your hosts are Lisa Monaco and Ken Weinstein. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. The editorial producer is Jennifer Indig. And the CAFE team is David Kurlander, Nat Wiener, Matthew Billy, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. And our music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you for being part of the CAFE Insider community.